Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the toll-free number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our call, some topics to talk over this time.
Yes, yoga. Years ago, when I first got interested in yoga, everyone really wondered, what is this yoga about? But now, of course, you can go anywhere in America practically and see a yoga studio. We'll talk about its benefits, where it came from, and what its means. And herbal supplements. Mm-hmm. What you see is not always what you get.
I know you're skeptical often of herbal supplements.
Yeah,
we'll talk some
research
about that. What's our recipe?
Pomegranate, mango, guacamole.
I'm not looking at all forward to this recipe.
But do you like guacamole?
No.
No, you don't like guacamole. Do you like pomegranates?
Yeah.
How about mango? This is a non-Tom recipe.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Let's get to the phones now, Zorba. A listener joins us in Post Falls, Idaho. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I have had this strange problem probably for the past 17, 18 years. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of a chronic hiccup. And it's not quite the same, like, where you have it, like, Guinness Book of World Records type hiccup, where someone does every, you know, constantly for every 2 seconds for the past, you know, so whatever.
Yeah.
But it's a chronic thing that happens, like, one or two every hour, or, you know, every few here and there. And I have a feeling it is, of course, the obvious kind of acid buildup, acid reflux type, and that's kind of exacerbated it. But at the same time, since it seemed to have started like when I was around like 15 or 16.
Okay, so let me talk to you a little bit about hiccups. I've got some ideas here. First of all, hiccups they're from a nerve that basically is our diaphragm. That's the nerve that basically controls our diaphragm. There's certain things that can cause hiccups. Little babies always get hiccups, you know? You give them something, they start hiccuping, and you kind of laugh at them, and it's kind of funny. Adults get hiccups. We don't laugh as much. I used to get hiccups years ago when I was younger. Now I rarely get hiccups, and they can be very, very disturbing. As you said, it's not necessarily a nervous twitch, but it is a nerve, and acid reflux can be a key cause of hiccups. So I want to go back for a second. I had a patient in my practice who had intractable hiccups. This is years ago. And we tried everything, including phenothiazine antipsychotic drugs, the mainstay of which was Thorazine. And this is years ago. Thorazine was a major drug that we don't use at all today because it has major side effects. And Thorazine and Compazine, which we still use intermittently for nausea, actually stopped his hiccups. But he had intractable hiccups. We're talking about continuously throughout the day when he went to sleep at night. And so we use these heavy-duty drugs. We don't use them today. We have other drugs that we sometimes use. But often a cause of hiccups can be acid reflux. In other words, that may be the cause of your hiccups. And I've got an idea of what I'd like you to try. What I'd like you to do is get over-the-counter Prilosec. Prilosec, by the way, is a great drug. It used to be by prescription only, and it really shuts off the acid. Take it every morning on an empty stomach, 15 or 20 minutes before you eat. That's the optimal way to take it. Start out 20 milligrams a day. That's the over-the-counter dose. If that fails, go to 20 milligrams at breakfast and 20 milligrams sometime later in the day, and do it for 6 weeks. See if your hiccups disappear every single day. 6 weeks. Okay. Now let's assume, A, your hiccups disappear. Well, then you know it's acid reflux. Then instead of taking it every day, see whether or not you can get by with once or twice a week. You may not eat it every day. And then see if certain foods bother it. Like you said, alcohol, coffee, which can affect acid in the stomach, may do it. And it may be you become a teetotaler without caffeine, and that takes care of your hiccups. But I'd look towards the acid possibility first. What I would do, as I said, Prilosec in the morning, Prilosec in the evening. Do it for 6 weeks every single day. See if you can get rid of it. And then if that's the case, several times a week, and then change your diet and see what happens. And let us know. Call us back.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. You take care now.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Thank you. I'm glad you didn't ask for any sort of remedy to stop continuous hiccups, because we wouldn't have any other calls during the hour. There are so many hiccup-stopping remedies.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You can see how common it is.
Yeah.
You can see that. You know, yeah. You mean
well, drinking water upside down and
that's
all.
That's right. So, in other words, maybe to stop his hiccups, he'd have to drink water upside down.
Let's not get into that.
There are
a gazillion of them.
Why? Do you think people would chime in on their latest hiccup
recipe? I'm afraid.
I wonder if anyone has an opinion how to stop hiccups.
Carla's going to get a gazillion emails.
If so, it's zorbapastry.org, or, of course, we're all over Facebook. You can sign it on there.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, a listener joins us from Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Oh, I'm having a problem. I have an echogram done every year because I have nightly oxygen. So my medical doctor suddenly decided that he should go back on my files. I changed doctors. So he looked back on my files. He discovered that I have thickening of the heart vessel. I couldn't understand why it hadn't been found before, because I take yearly echograms. No one ever had said that to me before.
Mm-hmm. So let me go into this a bit. So first of all, you're on continuous oxygen for chronic lung disease, right?
Pulmonary hypertension.
Okay. So pulmonary hypertension, which is really a vascular issue. Okay. So you're on it at night for pulmonary hypertension.
Uh-huh.
And you get an echocardiogram of your heart every year or of the vessels and the vessels around the heart. And you've been doing that for how long? How many years?
Oh, Lord. More than 10 years.
More than 10 years. Okay. So one day you switched doctors. Why'd you switch doctors?
Well, I didn't switch my pulmonary doctor. I switched my medical doctor.
Okay. So you switch your medical doctor. By the way, that's not unusual. A lot of people will keep their specialist and switch for a whole bunch of reasons, insurance and other reasons. And the new regular doctor said that you've got
looking back at my record, he found that I had thickening of the heart vessel. And he wanted to do an echogram the next day, which I did do.
So he was worried about it.
Mm-hmm. He was worried about it. Well, okay. I got terribly upset, so my pressure went to 160 over 100.
Sure. Who wouldn't get upset? I'd be upset, too.
I couldn't understand why no one had ever said this to me in my life.
Sure. So let me ask, what was the second echocardiogram? What did it show?
He said it was okay, but it still showed that I had some thickening. So then he said, I want you to take HCTZ, which I used to take blood pressure, HCTZ, 25 milligrams years ago, but then I stopped because my pressure got down low and it stayed low.
Mm-hmm.
So then he said, I'm going to give you this medication with atropine. And so I said, well, I have some HTZ at home that I haven't been taking. So he said, well, just break it in half and take it.
Okay.
So I said, okay.
So the real issue is, why didn't anyone tell you about this, and what do we do about
That's
it too?
Right.
So let me give you a bit of a perspective, and although I don't have a crystal ball to see. One of the reasons that we do yearly echoes in an echocardiogram for people with pulmonary hypertension and other problems is to look at the progression and see whether or not there's a progression in the blood vessels and in the valves. There are a lot of issues that are involved there that they might want to step in by reducing the blood pressure with something such as hydrochlorothiazide. When you went to your new doctor, he or she must have looked back and saw the report and said, it looks like there's some thickening. And then there must have been some thickening in the past. It might have been marginal thickening in the past.
Uh-huh.
Might have been marginal. Could have been missed, but it could have been marginal. And that's not unusual. And then it crosses the threshold where you say, wait a minute, it's no longer mild. It's now in the moderate range. We've got to make sure we reduce the blood pressure. So not having the information in front, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but this is not an uncommon thing. I can tell you that. If you're concerned, getting a second opinion from a cardiologist is a great idea. You like your pulmonologist, but if you're concerned and you wonder, should I really be on this or not, I'd either discuss it with a pulmonologist or I would go get an opinion from the cardiologist. But this happened. This is not uncommon. That's why they do yearly echoes. And then your new doc looked and said, you know, this thickening has been there for a while, but most likely, and I'm not sure, if it wasn't missed, yearly echoes, people really look at them. They should look at them with a fine-tooth comb. It just crossed a threshold, and then they say, we have to act on it. That's pretty common. Good luck. Let us know what happens, yeah. Okay?
Thank you so much for the call at 1-800-462-7413.
You know, Tom, this is not unusual. This is common where people say, wait a minute, why didn't you tell me about this before it was back? And it crosses a threshold often. And then we look back and we say, you know, this has been there before. Now, sometimes the doc has actually missed something. And, well, that's where we do yearly echoes in a situation like this to make sure we don't miss something. And then sometimes it's just a progression. And this particular question that she had is extremely important because this is where having a good relationship with your doctor really makes a difference. And she sounded like she was upset. Obviously, she was upset. And the real question is, there's a relationship issue here that's very important because process is important for anybody with chronic disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, Zorba, you say you have some new info on yoga, which you say can change your body from day one?
Change your life from day one. Well, the real issue has to do with moving your body. I recently read a book called The Human Body by Daniel Lieberman. Wonderful, wonderful book. Talking about really hunters-gatherers when we started agriculture and a whole bunch of other things. And his point throughout the book is that we were never designed as humans evolutionarily to just sit on our derriere and not do anything. And the real issue is, back about 20, 25 years ago, the idea was the only way to really improve your body is through weight training, balance training, aerobics. Yoga was a communist plot, an attempt to really disturb our children
and
move
it
into an Eastern religion. Well, that was kind of the impression I remember yoga years ago.
Okay.
It was in the same realm, but new information basically shows it does a whole bunch of things. First of all, it lowers cortisol levels, which are related to stress and heart disease. There's no doubt about that. It improves. Some people say it improves brain function. I think it improves brain function as much as other exercise. It's a different form of exercise. Lowers blood pressure in the same way, improves capacity of your lungs. It may improve sexual function, reduces anxiety, reduces neck pain. It's really not new information. It really shows you, though, that this other form of exercise is incredibly good. And I think it's really that stress level point of view. You know, for a lot of people, they're not interested in going on the treadmill, which is good aerobically, but they will do yoga. And I think this information shows, once again, it's exercise. Tailor the exercise that you want to do to yourself so that you'll get some benefit from it.
You know, there are yoga instructors, in fact, all of them, I think, keep learning year after year after year and never learn all the yoga.
Oh, right, all the asanas.
Like there are thousands.
Right. Well, I mean, come on, it's an ancient unit. It's an ancient Eastern issue. The first person who brought yoga to the United States was a guy named Vivekananda, who by the way, died of diabetes. He was an insulin-dependent diabetic, and he died back in the 20s. And he went around the country introducing yoga to elk clubs and rotary clubs. And I've got a picture of him and Shriners standing in front of a bunch of Shriners in Los Angeles. And you can see there are these Shriners with their shrine hats with this long yogi, and he's introducing the new, quote, Eastern form of exercise and meditation.
You and I did a yoga session together.
We did.
That wasn't a pretty picture.
And you know what it was? It wasn't. And as you said, we did a yoga section.
Right.
That was it. A meaning one.
800-462-7413.
It was not our best day, Tom.
It certainly wasn't. I was better than you were, though.
You were much better than I was. I will give you full faith and credit for that. You were able to pretzel your way into those stances, and I was not doing it.
1-800-462-7413. On we go to Rapid City, South Dakota. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Oh, well, I have a problem that I've had for about 10 years. They're headaches, which I've been told are called cluster headaches. they're extremely, extremely painful headaches. And I'll, about once or twice a year, I will get these headaches. They come multiple times a day, and they last for weeks up to a month to 6 weeks. And I've always struggled to try to find what causes them, what I can do to prevent them, or even what I can do to make them go away once they start.
Yeah, who have you seen for this? Have you seen a family doc, internist, a neurologist at all?
Yes, I saw a doctor when I was in college at the university. I have gone to a family doctor. I actually had surgery on my septum. I had a deviated septum.
What'd that do? Did that do anything for them?
It seemed to help, but now they're coming back again.
Sure. They're awful when they happen. Cluster headaches are like migraine headaches. They just obviously they're just. I mean, I'm a migraineur. I get migraines, not as many as I used to. So I can just imagine the suffering. You take anything for it? Have you used oxygen for it? That's one of the treatments. Have you put lidocaine in the back of your nose or your throat at all?
No, actually, I've heard about the oxygen. Been told about that, and never, I guess, looked into it. And the lidocaine, I have not heard that before or tried that.
I have a couple of ideas for you, and then we're going to put a bunch of stuff on our website at zorbapastor.org. If you go to our website, I'll put a bunch of things. First of all, cluster headaches like migraines are awful. And there are medications that have been well-tested for migraines, medications like Topamax, which is an anti-seizure medicine often used in chronic pain, gabapentin, another anti-seizure medicine used for chronic pain. Oxygen apparently works for cluster headaches, can work quite well. There's an old-fashioned antihistamine called periactin that some people take for migraines, take it every day, that some people say actually works for cluster headaches. And then there have been a couple of different studies on the use of lidocaine up in the back of the nose for cluster headaches, where you put lidocaine gel, which you can get by a prescription, you put it up there, or in the back of the septum, you know, and as you noticed there was a difference when you had your deviated septum worked on. There's no absolute cure for these. One question I have is, if you had to take something every day, you know, to keep these things from happening, because they come twice a year, but they come with a vengeance and they last for a while, would you take something every day?
Yeah, I would take something every day. I would be, you know, concerned about side effects.
Sure. Okay, we're going to put a bunch of things, because they're not as well studied as beta blockers, but there are a bunch of other things. I will, as I said, on the website, put a bunch of things. And then I talk to your family doc. Bring the list into your family doc and say, hey, I want to try these different things for cluster headaches. Beta blockers, anti-seizure medication. Some people will have oxygen at home in a small tank that they actually use for cluster headaches. Some people will try the lidocaine cure. We'll put it all on the website to look at it. They're awful, awful things. And one other thing about cluster headaches is sometimes people do find triggers. Quite often they don't. They're random. But they do find triggers. So when you get your cluster headaches, try to do sort of an inventory of what's going on. Have you been under stress? Or have you recently changed your diet? Did you go and you travel? And just write it on the calendar to see whether or not you find a pattern, because there might be a pattern to this. Okay?
I will.
Good luck. Yep. And we'll get you some more information.
Thank you so much for the call. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take an email question from a concerned, loyal listener, Angela. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, due to a recent diagnosis, it's been suggested that I receive an ablation surgery from my cardiologist. It's my understanding that this surgery has a very good success rate, but I'm still unsure of having this done. I would like to get a second opinion and wonder how best to search for someone. I found a cardiologist who has done ablations before, but how would I know if this person is a good doctor or not?
Well, first of all, how do you interview and find a doctor? Where were they trained? What was their training? Are they part of a clinic, a large clinic? Small group cardiologists may be independent. If they're part of a large clinic, what's the reputation of the clinic? What's the reputation of the hospital? I mean, there's no easy one thing to really tell. But one thing that I always find useful is how many of these have you done, doctor? Mm-hmm. Is it a new cardiologist who's done 10 of them or 15 of them? Or is this somebody who does them all the time? So I would ask the number. I would call up. I would see it. They're usually done 90% of the time, 95% of the time in the hospital. I would find out if there are other cardiologists who do this in town and who does the most, who covers it by the insurance. Mm-hmm. And then if she has a question, she gets a second opinion from another cardiologist. Now, should everyone have ablation therapy? Absolutely not. So for many people, they will take drugs every day. But taking a drug every day to stop that fast heartbeat, it has side effects too. Mm-hmm. So it's a function of what she's going to have the ablation therapy for. The SVT, supraventricular tachycardia, ablation therapy has been around for a long time, more than a decade, decade and a half. They're really good at that. Now, ablation therapy can also be used for something called atrial fibrillation. It has more risks.
If you have a question for Zorba, just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. Or don't forget, you can message us through Facebook.
Our recipe is coming up. After our recipe, we have some more of your calls. We have our medical myth buster later in the hour, some more research to talk over too. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, for some reason or other, we have a recipe for pomegranate mango guacamole.
For some reason or other. Come on, we need variation on guacamole, and you're not a guacamole fan.
I don't like any of those things.
You like pomegranate, you don't like mango.
Is there something guacamole in this recipe that I might enjoy? Well, we'll find out.
We'll find out. But you know something? I think we'll call this we're going to christen this Tom's Dip. That's what we're going to do. We're going to call this Tom's Dip because Tom doesn't like it, and that would be kind of like an oxymoron.
You're saying I'm a dip? Anyway, let's do it.
Okay, so I happen to love guacamole, and any variation of guacamole I find interesting. Oh. Did you eat avocados when you were a kid?
No, I didn't like them.
Never. I didn't even know they existed. I happen to love avocados. I love, especially during party season, to make an avocado dip. And this is a variation, really, on guacamole. Yeah. So anyone who likes guacamole, it is a simple recipe which will add variation to anything you're doing if you'd like to have dip.
Okay.
Start out with four ripe avocados.
Four ripe avocados.
Now, Tom, as you know, when you go shopping, there are two kinds of avocados. They're the avocados. You're smiling. Avocados that have quite a sort of that crinkly appearance and the avocados that are smooth. Which ones do you like?
Maybe I haven't tried the right kind of avocado.
I would buy whatever is on sale.
Okay.
Avocados can be expensive. Cheaper for our California listeners than they are to us because they're hard to ship. So
yeah.
Four ripe avocados. 1 cup of chopped onion.
1 cup of chopped onion.
Now, you can make it a white onion if you want it white. You can make a red onion. Yeah. I kind of always like to add color to what I'm doing, so I will often use red onions if I have them around the house.
Okay.
Okay, 2 fresh serrano chilies.
Two fresh serrano. Now, what are serrano chilies?
They're just a type of chili. They're not as hot, you know, as a habanero chili, mm-hmm. which would be super hot. You know, if you go to the store and really you look in the fresh vegetable section, mm-hmm. you'll see a lot of different chilies. And I recommend people try different chilies and things to see if there's a hotness. Yeah,
I like onion and I like chili.
I think you'd
maybe
like,
I could
like
get serrano. The hotter kind of chili, yeah, and it exactly. would overpower.
It would overpower
the
it. There it is. It would overpower it. And a recent study that I looked at, I knew the chilies that if you wanted to have less heat, you would get rid of the seeds. But it turns out most of the capsaicin is in the pulp that's right in the center.
You told me that recently on the
pulp
radio.
Pulp right in the center of the chili. Yeah. So be careful when you work with the chilies. Don't get them on your fingertips and scratch your eyes like I did one time.
Yeah.
1/4 cup of fresh lime juice. Do not use reconstituted lime juice.
Right.
Fresh lime juice.
1/4 cup fresh lime
that's
juice.
That's right. Okay. 3/4 cup of pomegranate seeds.
3/4 cup of pomegranate seeds.
Now, you're looking here to see, well, you know, pomegranate, if you open up a pomegranate inside are seeds, and that's where the pomegranate juice is.
Oh.
It's around the seeds. And people tend not to eat pomegranates because the seeds themselves, they have to do all this. They have to. You know, but some people don't like pomegranates. I happen to like pomegranates, mm-hmm. but the juice is right around the seeds.
Okay.
3/4 cup of diced peeled mango. You could use frozen mango if mangoes are not in season at your local store.
3/4 cup diced peeled mango.
That's right. If you like cilantro, 1/2 cup of cilantro. Mm-hmm. If you don't like cilantro, don't use cilantro and put the cilantro on the side. I have discovered in my life 50% of the people like cilantro and 50% do not.
Okay.
It's a 50-50 proposition. Okay. Number one, have and pit the avocado and coarsely sort of chop it in a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
You could do that, couldn't you?
I guess.
I don't think I'd
want to, but I certainly
stir in the onion.
Try.
You could do that too. Stir in the fresh serrano chilies that you've chopped up. 1 1/4 teaspoons of salt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then fold in the pomegranate seeds, mango, and cilantro. Okay. Season with salt and additional lime, and you're done.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Simple. Mm-hmm. You could do it.
Yeah, I could, I guess.
You could if you wanted to.
Yeah.
If you want a copy of today's recipe, I bet I can tell them where to find it.
I bet you can, too.
You can go to ZorbaFaster.org. You can see pictures of Tom, pictures of me, lots of other fun stuff. That's ZorbaFaster.org. And remember, we are all over Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And back to the phones now, Zorba, a listener with us in Pocatello, Idaho. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
I have experienced my feet burning at nights. It burns so bad that I have to get up in the middle of the night and go to my refrigerator in the freezer and get one of those cold packs to put on it. And I hang my feet outside of my covers all night long, but it never the cold pack never helps. So it's within the feet itself. And it's mainly on my left foot that it starts on. Prior to that, I had experienced a sciatica pain down my small of my back through my left leg. And I wondered if that is causing it.
Mm-hmm. Foot pain, you've had it for how long?
3 years.
3 years. Have you taken any pills for it, by the way?
No, I take ibuprofen. Uh-huh. I'm not a pill taker.
Not a pill taker. Okay. When was have you ever been checked for diabetes, by the way?
Yes, I have.
Uh-huh. And do you have diabetes?
No, I don't.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. Okay, foot pain, burning foot pain. Not totally uncommon, certainly not rare at all, often caused by diabetes. That's what I asked. It's what we call a peripheral neuropathy. Peripheral meaning on the outside. Neuropathy means the nerve's doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a peripheral neuropathy. Diabetes, I mentioned, is the most common thing. B12 deficiency can cause it. It's a whole list of things that can do it. Rare diseases like lead poisoning. But the most common cause after diabetes is what we call the idiopathic kind, which means we are idiots as doctors. We don't know what actually causes it. But the treatment for it, especially with sleep people at nighttime to sleep, is to take a drug called gabapentin, a drug that I happen to like, used to be name brand, produced by Pfizer, very, very expensive. Full disclosure, years ago we tested gabapentin when it was name brand for Pfizer, because I do clinical research. And it was quite effective for peripheral neuropathy. There's another drug on the market called Lyrica, not name brand. brand. It's expensive. I tested that one, too. It works well. I don't use that drug very often because it costs much more. But gabapentin at nighttime may help you. 300 milligram capsule taken an hour before you go to sleep or something like that. Lasts for about 6 to 8 hours. May be a real bonus for you. And the problem with peripheral neuropathy is what is going to work for it. You've known that ice packs, that they do work for some people. For other people, over-the-counter capsaicin cream, which you rub on on nighttime on your feet. Bengay will work for other people. And some people find acupuncture works and something called the TENS, T-E-N-S unit, which produces electrical stimulation. But frankly, the gabapentin is really effective for easily about 75% of the people. And I think I'd try that.
Okay. The pain doctor that I'm going to now has given gabapentin, but he started with 10 milligrams, and now he's boosted it to 20.
Gabapentin, you may not be on the same drug, because gabapentin is like 100 milligrams and 200 milligrams. So I'm not sure what you're getting from the pain doctor, but I would go to the full dose of gabapentin, 300 milligrams at bedtime. If that doesn't work, I double it to 600, and if that doesn't work, I would go to 800. So that's what I would recommend that you do. I don't think you're getting gabapentin from him if it's 10 to 20 milligrams, but go look at the bottle, talk to your pain doctor, and try that drug. I think it's your best bet. Okay? Let us know what happens.
All right. Thank you so very much, Dr. Zorba.
800-462-7413, an open line now for you at 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, on we go to a listener in Rochelle, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I was wondering if it's myth or fact, the benefits of raw apple cider vinegar.
Wait a minute. What do you mean, myth or fact? What is the myth, or what do you think apple cider vinegar will do?
The benefits of it is supposed to be help control cholesterol, blood pressure, sugar levels. And I was wondering if this is actually fact.
Yeah, well, I think it's myth, but I'll tell you why and where it started. Mm-hmm. It started in the 1950s, way back when in the 1950s.
This is going to be a long story, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's one of these stories like from Lake Wobegon. But there was a guy, I don't think his name was Howard Jarvis, but something like that. Yeah. He was from Vermont. He wrote a book that became a bestseller called Folk Remedies in Vermont. And he wrote that a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar was really good. Book became a bestseller, blockbuster. We're talking about millions and millions. There were no talk shows back in the 50s because, frankly, there wasn't much television that you could talk on because those would be the test patterns that Tom and I used to sit and watch when we were kids. So he then manufactured something called Honeygar, which was honey and apple cider vinegar. Sold like hotcakes. Then the FDA said, you can't do that. The FDA says you can write a book about apple cider vinegar, but you're claiming on your Honeygar that this works and stops those diseases from happening, so you can't claim it. So they put a cease and desist order on him. So he stopped manufacturing it. The book continued to be a bestseller for years, and then it kind of caught on. So people say, well, you know, apple cider vinegar gets rid of my cholesterol, helps my sex life, makes me better, grows hair on my head. It has a whole bunch of things that people think it actually does. The fact is, apple cider vinegar is vinegar. You know, it's salad dressing, and a lot of people eat it every single day because they eat salad dressing that has vinegar, and it happens to come from apple cider. Absolutely no proof. None at all. A lot of scientific research on apple cider vinegar because you're not going to test it. You can't make any money on it as a generic. So, and then I've looked into it for years on and off, and I think it's quackery. That's what I think. I think it's junk. If you want to take it, you feel better. And a lot of people do. They say, I take a teaspoon and it feels good. And you know what? I feel good when I have any salad dressing on my salad, too. It makes me feel satisfied.
Well, the reason I ask this is because my doctor said, flat out said he had a patient on diabetes. It lowered her diabetes 40%, and I didn't know.
I don't think apple cider vinegar is going to be the cure for diabetes. I'll tell you something. If apple cider vinegar would lower an average patient's blood sugar by 40%, that would be a non-drug way of controlling your diabetes. And you better believe that we would hop on that bandwagon right away and stop prescribing pills for many people. So my guess is She changed her life.
All right. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for the information.
Yeah. You're welcome.
We appreciate the call. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, we've been getting a decent amount of listener feedback about your opinion on coconut oil. An email from a loyal listener, Amy, best addresses this potentially sticky topic. She writes, "Dear Zorba, I have always heard you say don't use tropical oils. They are bad," in reference to coconut oil. "I'm a believer in eating real food, that is raw milk, grass-fed butter, and meats, and I stay away from anything hydrogenated or processed as much as possible. Many who eat this way replace hydrogenated soy or vegetable oil, for example, with coconut oil. Can you enlighten me as to why this is a bad idea? Is it environmental issues and deforestation you refer to, or does the oil somehow negatively affect us when ingested?"
Got you. And she is not the only person to look at this. So let's look at coconut oils. Mm-hmm. First of all, let's look at oils themselves. We hydrogenate oils, and they are industrial oils to improve the shelf life of products. And we now know that trans fats and hydrogenated oils are bad for us. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can have that Twinkie or whatever you're eating on the shelf for 100 years, and it's not going to spoil. But the less natural an oil is, really, generally, you'll say the worse it is. So if you get coconut oil from eating coconuts, well, that's totally different than if you're using coconut oil in cooking and otherwise. So let's look at what the good oils are. The good oils that we know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, are olive oil and canola oil, and by analogy, also rapeseed oil. Those are really the good oils. The coconut oil lobby, if you will, has started producing more and more coconut oil, which also happens to be inexpensive, easy to produce. What she talks about a deforestation is because there are more and more forests that are cut down in Malaysia and Indonesia, which they're produced. Mm-hmm. And so the coconut oil manufacturers have decided to, in the end, say, well, look, we're not doing hydrogenated coconut oil. We're doing a coconut oil that spoils. That is a better oil than hydrogenated coconut oil. No doubt about it. It's better because it's natural. Mm-hmm. However, it still is not olive oil. It still is not canola or rapeseed oil. And so therefore, in my mind, mm-hmm. it is still not an ideal oil. Now, is there scientific evidence that we look at it? You know, do we have any double-blind studies that have people on olive oil and people on coconut oil to see if there's a difference of heart attacks? No, we don't.
But why do you say it's not as good as the other one? What is it
about?
The
other oils, Mediterranean diet that uses olive oil has been shown beyond a shadow of a doubt to reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes. In other words, we've got good information on olive oil. If you're just looking at cholesterol numbers, that's not nearly as important as if you're looking at life and death from olive oil.
But we don't know what it is in coconut oil?
Well, back about 20 years ago, when coconut oil was all hydrogenated, we knew that it wreaked havoc on cholesterol and other lipids. Now that we have these new types of coconut oil, doesn't seem to be nearly the same. However, you've got money behind the advertisement for coconut oil because it's cheap and inexpensive. You've got lots of studies behind the Mediterranean diet. Why not go for the gold with what you know is good?
If you want Zorba to spill the raw facts, just send your question along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some more research to talk over. That's coming up next. More of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster right here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, we take another look at herbal supplements, which you talk about a lot here on the program. Apparently, according to this research, they're not what they seem.
Right. And, you know, we've talked about this before, and this is very, very disparaging because the feds have never taken leadership of this. So let's look back, first of all, in the past. 1994, a federal law was passed, moved by Orrin Hatch of Utah, which, by the way, has a ton of herbal supplement companies in there, that the feds cannot regulate them like drugs. Okay, so they were regulating them like drugs. A whole bunch of herbal supplements then came out, and they could say things like prevents. They can't say prevents prostate cancer. They can say encourages prostate health. Okay? So in other words, they can do it all by innuendo. They can't do it directly. Yeah. However, they are now regulated in the same way cosmetics are. You know, use this cosmetic and you'll get younger and look more vital. It's the same exact law that does it. And as a result, the feds are asleep at the wheel. So this particular study, Canadian research tested 44 bottles of popular supplements, things like echinacea that are used to prevent a common cold, 12 different companies. They found out that most of them were not what they claimed to be, that they're often replaced by cheap fillers, by soybean, by wheat, by rice. For instance, they had a St. John's wort to treat a depression, and it turned out it was made by nothing at all. There was an Alexandria senna, which turned out to use an Egyptian shrub, which is cheap and inexpensive. It turned out that a lot of these are weeds, so they're not filled with anything. In other words, here it is. You want to buy echinacea, and in the end, you're not getting echinacea, you're getting weed, and you're eating the weed, and you know what? You might have side effects from that weed. So not only are you not getting what you pay for, but you're also getting something that you didn't pay for.
You mean there isn't anything in the that is
right.
What
there's nothing in the supplement in some of these pills. Now, this has been a big issue for years. A company that I go to, an organization that I go to, consumerlab.org, which is an independent company. You pay every time you go in there. I think it's $25 a year, or it's $4 or $8 a month. And they test supplements. What they do is they independently test them. Consumer Reports, by the way, also has a dynamite website. They also charge, although you can get Consumer Reports at your local library often. And my recommendation is if you're taking a supplement, do not take it unless it's been tested by someone independent.
So some of these are okay.
Some of these are okay. Now, if you get a brand, not – when I say a name brand, it's like a company like Walgreens or Target or somebody else. They're often going to stand by it and make sure that the supplement actually has something. But if you really want to go for the gold, go to consumerlab.org, get the information or Consumer Reports, and then you'll know what you're getting. This is Truth in Advertising.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll free. And our next caller, Zorba, is in Bozeman, Montana. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I've got a malaria question. I've got a daughter. She's in West Africa right now in Cameroon, pretty isolated in a little town called Timbati. She's been taking anti-malarials the whole time but started feeling sick.
What kind of symptoms does she have?
She mainly is just a fever and a little achy.
How high is the fever?
102, and it was just camped there, didn't get any higher, and now it's actually started to go back down. But but she's prowling around the jungle every day. Yeah. I mean, she's out there doing field study, chasing indigo birds.
Yeah, she has something going on, you know, and you can't tell from just a fever. You know, it could be a virus, it could be a cold, it could be dengue. Usually with dengue and malaria, you're really sick. I mean, you get these spiking fevers. They're higher than 102. The same for dengue. You're prostrate. You know, you just can't move. You become dehydrated. You can't drink. You know, you have trouble drinking water, and there are a whole bunch of other side effects. So, you know, on the first flush, it seems to me like she may have something that's benign. But, you know, I know you're worried as a parent. Obviously, I would be worried. Where is the nearest doctor or medical clinic where she is?
What? There's a small clinic in the village, but she's a little worried just about, I mean, its capacity since, I mean, she's had some interaction with other institutions there, with the police. They got robbed early on, and the police's main method was to sacrifice a goat to do some divination.
Sacrifice a goat to do some divination about the robbery?
Yeah, to figure out who stole their computer.
Goodness.
Well, I would be concerned. Now, other issues. No injections. She should not have a needle. She should not have injections. And the reason is that's often what they do in developing countries. They'll say, oh, you need an injection. The needles, I don't trust any needles ever in developing countries, period, because that's a good way to spread things like HIV, AIDS, syphilis, and a whole bunch of other things. So if she sees anyone, no injection. If she continues to be sick, then she has to go somewhere to be seen. You know, she have anyone with her? She's chasing indigo birds?
Yeah. I mean, this is for a PhD at East Carolina University. And she's got a local Cameroonie, and then she has another student field assistant with her. But it's a 15-hour commute back to the capital.
If she is sick, okay, if she's really sick, 102 fever kind of doesn't worry me if she's taking fluids and stuff. But if she's still sick, she's got to hire somebody and get back to the Capitol to see. And yes, it is 15 hours, but if she's flat out sick and laying there and delirious, which she's not at this point, then she's got to get somebody to take her there. Keeping up the fluids, the most important thing. Taking something for the fever is going to help her if she's got ibuprofen, Tylenol, or aspirin. And often you can get one of those in the most remote places of the world. But the fluids are the most important thing. And sometimes you got to take that 15-hour trip just to see what she has. She has to do it.
Exactly.
Call her up, see how sick she is, and then do the right thing and figure out whether or not she has to go to the Capitol. That's going to be a far better way. Good luck.
Great. Thank you.
My kids traveled when they were younger. I feel for everything that you're saying. I empathize. You just want to eyeball and look at her and see what's going on, and that's what you want to do. But call her up, see what's going on. Okay.
Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Good luck, and thank you so much for the call at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, time once again now for our medical myth buster. This one comes to us from a listener, Daryl in Racine, Wisconsin. I frequently hear the old saying, feed a cold, starve a fever. Is this advice medically sound?
Not at all. It's feeding a cold and starving a fever. That's what my mother used to say. There's no evidence that medical advice does.
Is there any research
to
prove it?
Prove or disprove it?
Yeah.
I don't think there's ever been research where you feed people when they have colds and then you put them on a starvation diet when they have a fever. I don't think there's any medical research. So it's a folk remedy. You know, if your mother, what would you do? And by the way, what if you have a cold and a fever? A lot of people have colds and fevers.
Then you don't do either one. I mean, then you eat a little and you...
What if you have a fever and you just don't feel good? Do you have a cold? And we don't have sound definitions of these things. You know?
I live by this.
Oh, you live by it. Okay.
If I have a cold, I try to get a lot of food. I think it helps me. If I have a fever, I'm not that hungry anyway, so I stay away from food, get a lot of liquids.
A lot of liquids.
And I think it does me some good.
So you know what? We'll call this Tom's remedy. Feed
a
cold.
It's not mine. It's been going on for 100 years. I didn't invent it.
Or probably 1,000 years. It's probably gone on for a long time.
I tell you. You're laughing, and so is my wife, because I've tried that on her, and she says, wait a minute, I've always heard starve a cold and feed a fever.
So it's one of those,
one of those
judgment things.
I'll tell you what. I never do that. I'm going to the internet.
I love it.
And
you're going to the internet?
Finding the answer to that.
Oh, my God.
Because I don't trust you on it.
www.tom.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to address, just send it along in an email to...
Zorba@WPR.org or Facebook.
Our next call now, Zorba, a listener with us in Fernandina, Florida. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. How can we help?
Well, I want to know... what Dr. Zorba knows about light therapy. For the past 20 years, I suffered from horrible depression, not able to get out of bed. I mean, ruining my life and the life of my family. And I heard about light therapy, and I ordered a light therapy box, and I was able to wean myself off 60 milligrams of Cymbalta every day and 15 milligrams of mirtazapine. Since then, I have gotten my vocabulary back, my memory back, my quickness of a repartee.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
It's non-invasive.
You bet.
And I've lent my box out to some of my friends. They have just waved that.
Absolutely. Let me tell you a bit about light therapy because I think it's great. Seasonal affective disorder, which is one of the most common things light therapy is used for, is something that affects a lot of people. And years ago, I would tell people how to manufacture a light box using 4 fluorescent light bulbs, getting some wood together, finding a handyman. I'm not one of those handymen, so I find somebody else who's a friend. And I've had numerous boxes. And now what I do is I go to the net. I go to Amazon. There's an SAD box on Amazon that I like. If you go to Amazon, I don't get any money by this, by the way, and you put down SAD boxes, a little box that pops up 10,000 lumens. That's how much energy in the light. That's what's been tested. And when I travel, I use this box when I go through too many time zones. It resets my clock, and I use it at the beginning of Halloween when daylight savings time starts, and I use it for about 4 to 6 weeks. And I don't necessarily use it every day, but I use it most days, and I find it gives me energy. I don't get depression, but I get sort of tired, and I want more sleep. And what happens is the light box is very useful. So there have been a number of studies. It's mostly the seasonal affective disorder studies. But like you said, you can get off your drugs. Mirtazapine is an excellent drug. So is Cymbalta. But they have side effects. And they dull often the repartee. You hit an important point. It dulls your repartee because, among other things, it dulls the immediate emotional response to thoughts that you have. And so it dulls your repartee. I think if we put Tom on a little mirtazapine and Cymbalta, it would dull his repartee.
I love it. I've never heard the word repartee on our show before.
We've got the new use of the word, and if you ask me to spell it, I will not spell it correctly. But the reality is, yes, lend it to your friends, and they can also, these boxes now cost about $60 to $70. They used to be $300 to $400. But one thing I know about light therapy is that it's non-invasive, it's inexpensive, and trying it for a variety of conditions has no downside. Mm. So I think you bring up some very important points. Thank you so much.
We appreciate it. And before we go, Zorba, let's take an email question from Tom in Red Wing, Minnesota, who is desperately seeking snoozin'. He writes, "Dear Zorba, I have a typical old man question. On most nights, I awaken with a supposed need to urinate 2 to 3 times. In fact, if I awaken hearing that my wife is doing the same, my body seems to say, well, she's taking care of her body, why aren't you? Other nights, I sleep through the entire night. In fact, if I take a product such as Aleve Nighttime, I sleep through without any problems. Do I need medication?"
Well, you know, he's taking a leave nighttime.
Yeah, that works,
and
apparently.
It seems to be works for it. And Aleve Nighttime has an antihistamine, which is Benadryl, diphenhydramine, and a lot of people use it. And some doctors say, well, you shouldn't use it, it disturbs sleep. But frankly, a lot of people use it and they find it works just well. So I would stick with it. You are medicating. It's working. I don't think anything more than that. It's benign. It seems to work. I would stick with it.
Make Zorba your number one source for health advice. Just send your question along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. Or don't forget, you can ask those questions on Facebook.
Next week, another hour of repartee.
We'll see you then. You've used it in a sentence. Yes. See you then, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And remember, Facebook, Facebook, Facebook.
Mm-hmm. And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1116Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.